tell their listeners and viewers, this is Ron Stefanski, host of Disrupt Ed. Welcome to another episode where we get to talk to the disruptors, those seemingly ordinary humans who are making an extraordinary impact on this ginormously disrupted world of workforce and education. What I learned is a long time ago is that I am not a cool person. I aspired to be cool at one point, but I gave up when my teenager boys told me, you know, Dad, you're never going to be cool. But I am on this show, Cool Adjacent. I'm able to bring really cool people together. And so that's what we're going to do here. I'm going to introduce you to both of them, and then we'll get the show started. First, we have Jason Aubrey, a thought leader in the healthcare training space, former CEO of MedCerts, and now the current founder of SkillTrade. Jason, so great to have you on the show.
Great to be here, Ron. Thanks for having me.
And then we have legendary Michael Horn, a person who is an expert in leading disruptive innovation in the classroom and in education generally. Michael, it's so great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Glad we can make this work.
Yeah, so let's get into this. You know, what I want to talk about today with you guys is what it means to build a future-ready workforce in this ginormously, changing landscape. So, Jason, I'm going to start out with you because you're easy to pick on first because you have a very simple tagline, which is future-ready talent. So what was the moment, I want to understand this, you know, what was the moment where you recognized that traditional training was not getting it done, was not responding to the needs of employers, and it also wasn't responding to the needs of the learner?
Yeah, I mean, Ron, for me, it actually wasn't like a single aha moment, but it was more of a compounding realization from working closely with employers nationally over the years. And I kept hearing the same frustrations, you know, quote, we can't find people with the right skills, or our new hires aren't job ready despite their degrees. What became clear was that the traditional training models simply weren't agile enough to respond to the rapid pace of industry change. So they generally focused on broad knowledge, right, which is very valuable, but they weren't consistently delivering the specific practical competencies employers needed like right now. And so the moment you see a hospital, healthcare system, for example, desperate for surgical techs, but facing a multi-year pipeline for graduates, you realize that the system actually isn't serving either the learner or the employer effectively. And so that's when the future-ready talent became a driving purpose for us. And, you know, we're focusing on exactly what's needed right now and how to do that efficiently and affordable in a rapid time frame.
You know, Michael, you've been following disruptive innovation in education and adult training for many years now. And when you think about it and look at today's workforce challenges as Jason described them, you know, for me, I'd like to understand, you know, what are the, you know, sort of old assumptions that led to what Jason's talking about, and then, you know, the ones that we are still clinging to that we really need to jettison if we're going to move the ball forward, as they say.
Where do you start? So many old assumptions. I think the first one, right, is that the higher education system that we all accept as the next step after high school was only the next step for a minority of our citizens, right? It was not actually the dominant workforce training pathway. It was historically never built to deliver on what most employers needed out of talent and what most individuals needed for a really great fulfilling career. We extended a model over, you know, really starting after World War II over the next several decades. And then frankly, starting in 1980 or so, access to college became the rallying cry. And we took a model built on seat time, not built on learning, built on a set of educational requirements around the academy, not on what jobs and employers needed, et cetera, et cetera. We built a model that is not built for teaching and learning, but is built to optimize research. And we set all of a sudden said, if we extend it to everyone, magically, it will somehow deliver on their needs and employer needs. And the reality is never built for that. And so it has disappointed, I think, because of those assumptions.
You know, when you guys look at it now, I'd like to hear what you're thinking in terms of some of the things that you've witnessed that are working and that are changing the learning landscape and kind of advancing the ball, because I think we need to socialize that a lot more if we're going to get people understanding, you know, how unserviceable our current state is. You know, we're operating, as I said at the beginning, in a globally interdependent world. And, you know, make no mistake, if we're not moving things forward, there are other developing countries out there who are, and they leave us, that leaves us at a disadvantage for our children in terms of how they advance into the workplace and make contributions based on all the changes that are happening in the workplace.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. And I think there are some real shining lights. Like, obviously, Jason's led a couple of them, right? And he's building one right now that is really filling a critical need and shortage, right, in our workforce and in the economy. I think you can look at a lot of them, though. Western Governors University, if you want to look in the area of accredited universities. No coincidence that it is a new university founded, right, in 1997, with a very different mission, very different operating model, very different set of assumptions, and built around labor market demand. You could look at Reach University in the teacher education space. It's a great model of apprenticeship degrees that I think will be incredibly important. It's sort of the back to the future moment for the United States. But I think really blending experiential learning into the curriculum itself and thinking about it as the main meal, not the dessert, will be an incredibly important part of the future. I think you look at non-accredited programs in addition to what Jason's doing, you know, things like Merit America, right, for example, I think are great examples of really taking a population that needs a pathway into a good job, really figuring out what do those employers need and matching those things. So those are just, you know, we could go on. There's some great, I think, case studies out there of shining lights that have gotten great outcomes, but really rethought the fundamental assumptions, Ron.
Yeah, I think that's the key, what you just said, rethinking the traditional assumptions as it's being built. And now, Jason, you've had some considerable experience in this. You not only ran a very successful med search operation, but you've started an organization and I'd almost describe SkillTrade as a movement. I mean, the breadth and depth of your connections and strategic partnerships at the early, you're in the early stages, but you're working with Texas Women's University, you're working in Alabama, you're working across the country, really resetting expectations for what we can do to help hospitals with a critical need. And that's where, you know, that's where, in my mind, pandemic interrupted hit us the hardest in education, with teachers who decided to opt out, and we had a great wave of people leaving the profession. And the same is true of frontline care workers in the healthcare space. Many of them left with PTSD. Many of them left because they had just reached their limit. And so at a time when our health is not improving and we still require an extensive healthcare network, we don't have enough people to serve the need. So let's talk about what you're finding in your successful delivery of training in the healthcare space, because I think this is a really, really critical area.
Yeah, I mean, you also talk about the need and the pain points. And I'll give you an example. Just last week, I won't name the health system, but their nurses went on strike. And oddly enough, they didn't go on strike because they wanted better hours or a higher wage. They went on strike because they wanted to hire more people to help within the healthcare system. And that might be the case that the healthcare system, they might be trying, but they can't find individuals who are qualified or are talented. And so, you know, like many other training organizations, we're very specifically going into communities and building community-based approaches. What does that actually mean? That means who are the right partners and how do you deliver the right program modalities at the right time? So, you know, as an example, we work with Detroit at Works, the American Job Center, right, workforce agency in Metro Detroit. There's a cohort of 20 medical assistants. They're learning online, but every other Saturday, they're actually going to a medical facility that we partner with, and they're getting hands-on training. But in addition to that, we work with a nonprofit organization called Focus Hope. Focus Hope provides additional support for these individual students, whether it's motivational coaching, even at times transportation for those that have some barrier issues. And collectively, we're setting up clinical rotations with the local hospital systems. Some of our students who are actually active in that cohort are already getting jobs at Henry Ford Hospital, as an example. And so what the reason I'm saying this is because you asked, like, what are we finding in terms of partnerships and the approaches that are that make it successful? It's that. It's actually the community-based approach. And I really think that gone are the days of, I call it train and pray, right? Where you enroll a student, they go through the program, and you pray that they get a job and you help them find that job. What I think more training organizations, whether it's an accredited or unaccredited institution, are doing right now, they're working directly with the employers. And what I find really interesting is I think there's a lot of organizations that are being quite innovative in the model, right? I'm actually pretty impressed to see there's a few providers out there that are offering loan repayment programs. So they're raising hundreds of millions of dollars from hospital systems. And the hospital system is then saying, okay, well, if you're a nurse, you're about to graduate, but you have $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt, right? Because that's a big issue that we haven't even touched on right now, is the national debt associated with student debt. That the employer is saying to that nurse, right, that prospective employee, hey, if you work for me over time, I'll actually pay off that debt on a monthly basis. But the one thing about that is that actually really only helps the health system compete against their competitors to hire the critical staffing shortages. That doesn't increase the talent pool. But my point is, I do think that we're learning, and I actually think there is a movement, and it's exciting to see.
Yeah, just actually on that last, I think it's a great example though, because you imagine if more and more health systems and then maybe some state governments kick in to de-risk, right, that choice for an individual to go into a nursing degree, and you're de-risking it for the employer. So frankly, that they're not training, and then that person leaves after 3 years, or frankly, before 3 years, takes their talents to a rival health system, which is the zero sum poaching we're in right now. And then frankly, de-risks it so that the hospital system says, okay, I actually have clinical spots lined up. I can expand with confidence, and I can use online learning. So I'm not building out lots of new buildings, right, to do so. If you can just de-risk all three of those parties, I think that's how you actually start to get the supply up, Ron, of people coming into the profession. Because right now, you look at nursing, and I'm going to get the numbers wrong, it's like 4 in 10 don't make it through the full pipeline. They drop in, they drop out at some point, right? And that's pretty risky, because if you take on debt, you get no degree, right? Then the other option is you get the degree, but you can't find the placement, or you can't find the match, or something like that. That's risky, right? And so there's all these like little pipelines that 10% here, 15% here, 5% here sort of trickle out. How can we de-risk that across the system? And I think if we work for every single stakeholder taking out risk, you can bring up the number over time.
And I think also to talk about, you know, de-risking, right? I think what's relevant is potentially this myth that skills training is somehow a lesser pathway, right? Or exclusively for those who aren't college material. And I'm bringing this up because I think pathways, whether it's healthcare or not, is an additional way to de-risk and to lower the debt, to help an individual get a job faster and go towards that pathway towards a degree granting program. Like, so in reality, skills training, you know, example, what we do at Skilltrade, it's often the most efficient and direct route to a high demand, well paying job. And again, it doesn't have to be either or. I'm either going to go to a trade school, or I'm either going to go to a degree granting institution. You know, like an example is like our partnership with Texas Women's University shows that skills training can be a powerful on-ramp to a degree, right? So I can get a job as a medical assistant or sterile processing tech, but I can earn some credit towards a degree program. And as I'm working, as I'm earning a wage, I can then go back towards my degree, and then hopefully, because I'm working, that employer is going to sponsor me or help me with my debt. And I think it is a collective movement. And, you know, over time, I think it could actually solve a lot of our challenges in any industry and yield individuals who can come out of this actually making money, as opposed to, you know, in crippling debt, if that makes sense.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. You know, Michael, as you've observed all these systems, and you've mentioned some of the innovative ones, You know, online learning comes up as a question mark to a lot of people because in some respects, it has become perceived as a necessary part of the educational system. But at the same time, there are a lot of people that still feel it's a check the box proposition, that it's not necessarily fulfilling the goal of engaging students in their learning. You know, are you seeing promise in that space where online learning is actually capitalizing on the ability to turn education into a more engaged experience for the learner?
I am. And I think it comes down to two things, right? It's not the modality, it's how you design it. And are you focused on mastery, right? And so when you have clear learning objectives and you know what mastery looks like, you're not just passing people on because they happen to put their camera on for a couple hours and sort of disengage, right? Which is frankly the same problem we have in face-to-face classrooms that we never talk about. And then secondly, are you creating an active learning environment where I'm really part of it? And there's many ways to do that, right? It can be asynchronous where, you know, like Quantic School of Business and Technology, for example, it's a mobile learning, so online, right, way to get an MBA, for example. It is the most engaging MBA program I have seen anywhere by some measure. You are, you know, answering questions every 6 to 8 seconds, right, constantly engaged. So that's one version. I'm on the board of Minerva University at the other end of the extreme, where it's an active learning environment where Socratic conversations in very small groups. And I will challenge any seminar at any liberal arts university to be more active and engaged than the students are at Minerva University. I don't think you'll find it. And so it's not the modality per se, it's more what you do with the modality. And online extends a lot of value propositions in terms of access, capacity, frankly, using learning analytics to really personalize and make sure you're giving students what they need when they need it in ways that the traditional classroom is limited, but you have to take advantage of that.
You know, Jason, you mentioned something earlier that I want to bring into the conversation, and that is the community element. It seems to me that ultimately de-risking education is also about bringing it back to the community and having the community control, not necessarily control, but choreograph the movement, because we can't wait for help at the federal level, at the state level. They're not coming. You know, that's not necessarily a guarantee or a promise. And we've seen that in terms of the decrease in state assistance for our higher ed institutions, our public institutions here. So let's talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I actually think potentially help is coming. I was pretty encouraged to see the new legislation that was passed regarding Pell Grants. And the ability for community colleges specifically to leverage those for short-term certification programs, because prior to apply for FAFSA and actually obtain Pell Grant funding as a student and as an institution to get that program approved, the program had to be a minimum of 600 hours. Now they've changed that. And while I believe they're going to actually be negotiating the exact rules in November so that the policy actually comes out next July in 2026, what we think is going to happen is that programs between 150 above 150 hours, between 12 and 14 weeks, I think it is, are actually going to qualify, right? But this is only for accredited institutions, specifically community colleges. I think that actually is going to help a lot. I actually think that's going to help the community college system stay more relevant, be more competitive, because they're the ones specifically that, in my opinion, over the past few decades have been raising their hand saying, hey, we talk to employers, we know what their needs are, we can do something, but there isn't funding available for this. And I think that's actually a pretty positive policy from my perspective that's going to be adopted. And, you know, obviously we want to partner and power those types of programs for community colleges, but I do think there is some help coming. And what I've seen in this market, I've been in it for about 10 years, I haven't seen this type of alignment and commonality across the country in terms of higher education thinking this way, training organizations, partners like loan repayment and employers. I think what we've been doing is kind of like, you know, getting everyone on the same page. We're not there yet, but I'm seeing a difference now than, you know, 5 years ago for certain.
You know, that's really promising. Michael, are you seeing the same thing?
I agree. I mean, I actually think if you talk to state governors and get out of the Washington, D.C. echo chamber, they're all actually pretty uniform in the sense that they want to align higher education with the workforce needs. What I really admire about what Jason said in terms of the regional approach is a few things. One, labor markets are regional. And that's why you see individuals go to schools that are within 50 to 75 miles typically of where they live. But it's also because jobs, the way you get them is through social networks and things of that nature. And so connecting with the communities is so critical, and growing like a grassroots movement up is so important. You want the support from the top down. And I agree with Jason there as well. I think the short-term Pell, as it's often called, is a promising development. I may be a little bit more skeptical about community colleges' ability to handle it, but I think if they partner with folks like Skilled Trade, they'll be in a much better position to meet that demand and design the right programs for those opportunities, is what I would say. But so I think alignment, yes. I do think we're going to need some new institutions at the table to deliver on that alignment, or frankly, the existing institutions to partner or create some very different looking programs to meet that demand, because their traditional incentives, their traditional business models haven't been geared or focused on these things.
You know, before we pivot to another conversation, and that's how to create the learning model that works for jobs that don't yet exist, any last minute thoughts about what we've been talking about in terms of using novel approaches? It's very clear to me that both of you are very plugged into the idea that this has to be a partnership model where you're bringing different people together. I love the idea of community colleges, which we've supported abundantly since the Obama administration, with Jill Biden in the White House as well. But at the same time, we have to look realistically at the outcomes. And I think that a lot of partnerships help elevate that part of it, where you see better outcomes. So any last minute thoughts? And then we're going to take a break and come back for some more questions.
I mean, I'll add to that. I think, like, again, 10 years ago, and the employer role in shaping training, it was often passive. And I think they largely consumed talent produced by traditional institutions and that traditional model. And their feedback was mostly reactive, right? They tell schools what they weren't getting in graduates. And today it's a completely different landscape, as we've been discussing. So to your point and your question, I think that, like, with the acute skills gap and rapid technological change, training solutions, I think employers now are being far more proactive, and I think they need to be part of that solution. So they're demanding specific competencies. I think they should be seeking custom training solutions, you know, and increasingly investing in programs through initiatives like apprenticeships, and or like education as a benefit platforms, whether it's Guild or InStride or even Amazon Career Choice, right? They've realized that they can't wait. They have to actively participate in building their talent pipeline. And that's actually making a better education system at the same time.
Michael, your thoughts?
What he said.
No, I think that's right. So to our listening and viewing audience, you've been listening to two thought-provoking thought leaders, Jason Aubrey from SkillTrade and Michael Horn, former co-founder, I should say, of the Clayton Christensen Institute and best-selling author. And Michael, we need to talk about your books in the next episode, so remind me to ask you about them. But for those listening, hey, come on and get engaged with us. Give us your feedback about this and bring it. You know, what topics do you want to explore with these two thought leaders? Bring us your questions and your interests and get disrupted with us. We're going to take a short break and we're going to come back for episode 2. Stay tuned. Thanks.